Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And we have with us our special guest, Box tech consultant Tosin Anafuwakin. Listeners of our last few shows should by now be familiar with Tosin, and we welcome his expertise. How was your Thanksgiving, Tosin?
My Thanksgiving was really good. So I've recently moved to California, and home is actually Massachusetts. But for this Thanksgiving, I celebrated with a group of friends in the city, San Francisco, and just had a good time.
Nice. And how about yourself, Dwayne? How was your holiday?
It was awesome. I went to Seattle.
I just came back from Seattle. Before you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I went there for my girlfriend's family is in there. So I was there with her stepdad and her mom, and her mom made... Her stepdad makes normal, like, American, like, turkey breast and everything like that. But then she makes, like, oxtail soup and bibimbap and all this other great Korean stuff.
Wow.
So it was an amazing Thanksgiving. It's the first Thanksgiving in about 10 years where I didn't have to cook at all. So I was pretty excited.
Well, that sounds cooked a lot of bacon. Lots of candied bacon.
I also helped to cook in my household, but I live in a house full of vegetarians. And I cooked a turkey, and I cooked the whole turkey basically for myself. So I have a lot of turkey sandwich leftovers.
Your daughter's a vegetarian? How is that possible? She's a daughter.
She has embraced the vegetarian lifestyle. She's invented this stuffed animal superhero that attacks meat eaters also. So I get bitten by her stuffed animal superhero all the time.
Wow.
So, yeah, but it was a good Thanksgiving. Anyway, this week, we begin the slide into the holidays with Black Friday and Cyber Monday. Microsoft and Apple drop key team members. Apple patents the page turn. Nintendo launches the Wii U. And real and hoax Facebook changes get users nervous. So we have a number of headlines, and we're just going to just power through them. So, well, why don't we start off with the Thanksgiving and Black Friday? First of all, Instagram saw a new record set during Thanksgiving this year. 10 million photos shared at the rate of 226 per second at during the peak time of 12:40 p.m. Pacific. For several hours on Thursdays, users posted more than 200 photos every second. And the day broke all Instagram records, including the most recently set record, which was during Hurricane Sandy. So they broke that Hurricane Sandy record on Thanksgiving. Making it the busiest day for Instagram ever. The Facebook-owned company said that it saw the number of shared photos more than double from the day before. So I think this is more like a it's more than just a fluke because of a disaster like Hurricane Sandy. I think Instagram usage is going to just, you know, skyrocket from here on. I think Facebook made a great little investment when they bought Instagram, and I think Instagram was wise to let Facebook purchase them.
Yeah. Americans really love their filters. That's what I can really say about this. It's very interesting to think that it broke on Thanksgiving of all days, because, you know, this is at least the Thanksgiving it broke on was an American holiday, right? It's not Canadian. Thanksgiving, I believe, is a week before or a couple weeks prior. But there are that many people which are interested in it. And really, I think what helps Instagram a lot is their tie into the Facebook infrastructure.
Totally.
Right.
Totally.
That gives you a lot of users and quite an easy way to share it with them.
Yeah, I mean,
I also think there's a lot of food paparazzi that's going on.
Right.
No, I mean, it's a term. You can look it up. But I think what ends up happening is that a lot of people are like, look at my meal. I'm clicking now. And then people are like, oh, it's so awesome. And yada. So people do the food paparazzi on Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving is a unique American holiday in that it's about food far more than it is about religion, like most holidays. Or,
right.
Like, you know, what's the big, what are the big, when we say the holidays, we mean Thanksgiving, Easter, Christmas, and New Year. Right?
Yes, New Year.
So, like, and maybe Hanukkah, because it's in there too. Maybe Kwanzaa, if you're into that. Although that's a pretty secular holiday to begin with. But really, people are taking pictures of the food spread.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I did. This is what I made. I'm proud of it. I'm going to take a picture of it. And that's why it skyrockets at this time of year. Christmas might be the other thing too, but like, you have, your phone becomes secondary when you're surrounded only by your family. How many times have you been to Thanksgiving? I mean, Tosin went into this, and it's like, you know, not at home with a whole bunch of people who are also not at home Thanksgiving. And then it's a little less intimate, but it's just as fun. So,
yeah,
you know, then you're using your phone, you're Instagramming, you're doing whatever. And it also shows that the traditional camera is really, the point and shoot is really being taken over. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think it's, this is the perfect storm of both being acquired by Facebook and having that, just that huge user base open up to Instagram, and then the fact that it's a mobile app as well, as opposed to something that you upload. You know, you take pictures with a standard camera and upload from there. So it's just the perfect confluence of app and then social service. But speaking of Thanksgiving and huge numbers, immediately following Thanksgiving, as you know, is the biggest shopping day of the year, Black Friday. And this year was no exception. Retail e-commerce spending was at $1.042 billion this year, an increase of 26% from last year.
I don't think I bought a thing.
You didn't do any shopping on Black Friday?
Maybe I bought a T-Mobile hotspot for somebody else. Maybe it was $34. I just don't remember spending any actual money on Black Friday.
I actually did buy one thing, and I believe it was on Friday, maybe on Saturday, but I got the Xbox game Dishonored because I just heard so much about it from Devendra and other people.
Yeah.
And it was on Amazon and cheap.
Yeah, I got to say, here's the thing about Thanksgiving that's such a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Most companies give you, like Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt made sure that Thanksgiving was on a Thursday for some strange reason. And then every company in the world gave people the Friday after Thanksgiving off. Mostly because their kids have it off, because kids get a half day on Wednesday, and then voila. So you get 4 days of core holidays, no vacation taking holiday off. You get a 4-day break from work, which is unprecedented in America for a regular thing that everybody gets access to.
Yeah.
And that's kind of why you're like, I could go spend a day, like, running the fuck around to look for a deal. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're like, if Friday is stressful, I can always lay back on Saturday and Sunday because I have Friday off. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think, you know, especially with internet, with e-commerce and the ability to purchase online, it just makes life so much simpler for those who are not looking to face the crowds but looking for deals and special items. Although I only purchased one game, I did spend quite a lot of time looking at, you know, Amazon's black deals and special deals throughout the day. So I definitely clicked through a lot of the options, even though I didn't purchase anything per se.
Yeah, I you know, I had a hard time navigating all of the deals. But you know what I did get? My email inbox exploded.
It totally Black did, Friday. Didn't it?
It exploded on Monday, Cyber Monday. Yada, yada. I mean,
Cyber Monday.
When was the last time you guys used the word cyber to describe anything outside of a Neuromancer novel? Like, what the fuck?
Well, you know, cyber. Because that term was, you know, started back when cyber was a hip catch term,
but it's embarrassing now.
Now it's embarrassing. It's like virtual Monday.
Well, here's the thing. As a person who works in online marketing, it's not even about, like, we started to call it Cyber Week because like it's this whole week.
Friday, really, whatever. It is really the whole week.
It is the whole week, but it's just like the word cyber is almost embarrassing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, but I mean how the retailers, how online retailers just kind of naturally evolved a typically a 1 day shopping holiday into a 4 day shopping holiday by including the weekend and adding Cyber Monday.
It doesn't cost us any more money. Shh.
So I mean, you may have a point there. I mean, the deals there are great deals for certain items, and then for the majority of items, you can find just as good deals on almost any other day of the week.
Well, any other sale day of the week, it's a sale. There are sales going on. Things are cheaper, but the fact that it's that particular day doesn't make a big difference. It makes a big difference for offline retail. And that's because offline retail does little tricks, like says, hey guys, I'm going to, like, Walmart is guaranteed to have at least 5 of this thing that I'm promoting on Black Friday. So you have these great long lines of people hoping to get there early enough to take advantage of the proposed deal. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's where offline really makes a lot of money. They make up to 60%. No, I'm sorry. They make up to 40% of their annual revenue on Black Friday. Right. That's why it's called Black Friday. Because if you're in the red, you will go into the black.
Right. Well, I mean, there are other reasons as well. If you look up...
That's really like the reason. Yeah. That's like the reason. Like if you look it up...
If you look up on Wikipedia, it was coined by the cab drivers in Philly because of all the people going back and forth to the retail stores during that period, and basically the cab drivers considered it the Black Friday, like the hell day for themselves. But yeah, totally, it signifies the beginning of the new fiscal year, doesn't
I don't
it?
Trust Philadelphians. I'm from New York.
Just had to say.
But
I'm not sure I trust New Yorkers.
But
that's okay. You're from Massachusetts. You just wish you were one of us.
Cyber Monday, by the way, also broke records, too. It actually beat the Black Friday record from the Friday before. $1.5 billion in online sales. So let me ask you guys a question. Do you think that there will be a point where, like a tipping point, where online sales during the Black Friday, Cyber Monday holiday beat out... brick and mortar sales, that more people are shopping online than they are at brick and mortar stores?
I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're really close to it. Yes. People like I last year, I'll tell you this. Last year I got my like LED Sony 46 inch TV for less than like close to a quarter of what the cost was online.
Yeah.
On Friday, because I went from Best Buy to Best Buy Magnolia to a Sony store. So the direct to consumer guys, they're still making money, and that's they're at least getting rid of their inventory. And a big part of this is having retail stores empty inventory at a price that they can afford to gain some margin at. So I think that it's going to be a big retail thing as more retail happens online. I mean, you've got ShopRunner or whatever that's trying to compete with Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And those guys are going to try to empty their retail stores that have an online presence that are trying to empty their inventory too. But nothing is as efficient at emptying your inventory than having people show up at your store and take whatever's off the shelves off.
It's that's true.
That's going to be what it is for at least next year or the year after.
It's also kind of interesting to consider, you know, often online, at times online is cheaper, but that may not necessarily always be the case, especially with taxes now being enforced. For example,
right.
Amazon now taxing things. Well, so
you're in New York, they tax you. In Colorado, they complain that you might be taxed, but they don't really tax you. And in California, they may actually tax you. So
yeah, they just started taxing California, I think, a month ago or a few weeks ago.
I've noticed that.
It's a recent thing here.
But the taxes are like not, I mean, think about Prime and the shipping costs, and the taxes are really like whatever. Like you got to buy a lot of stuff to get like a tax hit that you're going to be upset about.
With the taxes, it really does pay to be on Amazon Prime for sure. It's definitely an advantage.
They should be our sponsor because they're fucking awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Plus the fact that you also get free, Amazon free features with Amazon's video service as well.
With the... Yeah, we haven't talked about the fact that Prime is now available to several people as a beta at $8 a month, not unlike Netflix.
Oh, you know, one thing I wanted to mention. Let's shift away from the Black Friday, Cyber Monday talk. I wanted to mention just briefly this article, Tosin, that you showed me before we began about Google expanding their max Gmail attachment size to 10 gigabytes.
And, whoa, what?
Yes.
Megabytes or 10 gigabytes?
10 gigabytes.
For an attachment?
Yes, for an attachment. And I think that's part of the fact that they're paired with Google Drive. So linking Gmail and Google Drive gives you the advantage now of...
So you get to use your entire bandwidth to upload humongous files.
Yes, well, and I was talking to Tosin that this, you know, can open up rampant file sharing, illegal file sharing via Gmail, you know?
No, like some people have just great big files on their computers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it definitely increases rampant file sharing, but it also increases their presence in the marketplace.
Absolutely.
For you know, sharing a la Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're definitely, their perception, it's a very interesting move to really try and integrate Google Drive into people's lives and make it a firmer presence than it currently is.
I have a 25 megabyte attachment limit on my Google situation.
Currently, they may not have rolled it out to.
I was told by Google that I can share it via Google Drive. You can now insert files up to 10 gigabytes in size, stored in Drive, yep, right into emails. So that's kind of what I'm seeing. I'm seeing less of a.
So they're really talking about is sharing a link via Google Drive that you would share that link. The same way that you would share a Dropbox link, for example.
Yes.
Oh, so nice. So they're really kind of like undercutting Dropbox.
I mean, it's $3.99. I don't know what kind of storage I'm allowed to have with Google, but we'll see as I drag files with Google, and we'll see if Google is like, oh, well, you don't pay for Google Drive yet, so you can get this. We'll see kind of how it is, but it seems to me.
You're cutting out a little.
I'm cutting out because I tried to upload an 845. That's like, but my Google Chrome.
There goes your bandwidth.
And I cut it off. So there's some kinks to be pulled out.
as demonstrated.
Real time vetting.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on here. So let's go a little bit back. We there was a lot of news that we kind of missed over the last couple of weeks that we were gone, and we're not going to go through like the whole list of headlines, but there were some key things that had happened. One of them, like, was like literally a day or two after we had recorded our last episodes, is that Windows unit president Steve Sinofsky had left the company, and this was less than a month after he launched Windows 8 and Microsoft Surface Tablet 2.
Have you guys played with the Surface yet?
I have not yet.
I've played with it a little, actually.
Today, actually.
Spent some time with the Surface. It's not a bad device, but it definitely needs a little bit of. You need a tutorial. It's not as intuitive as you would expect. You put your finger on one side of the monitor, you swipe it, you get a list of options that are great. But I rarely think to myself, I want to put my finger on the side off the glass and swipe in. Much like the Apple notification station, where you might get swiped on one side and the basic menu on another. You might tap the window icon on the Surface, which is behaves much like the button on an iOS device, and get a bevy of options. I guess part of me is I'm spoiled by iOS on the iPad.
Sure.
You see on the iPad. But another part of me is sort of like, it didn't take a lot of work for me to learn iOS on the iPad. Now, why is that? Because I had an iPhone, because I had an iPod Touch, because whatever. Like, iOS has taught people for the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
What Microsoft is challenged with is figuring out how to get people to know their system. There's also the fact that eventually you end up on the desktop, and the desktop behaves sometimes exactly the same and sometimes not exactly the same. And as a Microsoft lover, you're kind of like, I just want the desktop to behave like it should behave. Now, the saving grace is that keyboard and trackpad screen cover, which is amazing. Yeah. Like, you have a laptop and a tablet that are the same device without any weird Dell switch to flip screen, whatever situation. So that's kind of exciting. And that mouse pad really does work, and I really enjoy that. But I do feel like there's a learning curve the public has to make in order to make that Surface work well for it.
Yeah, I definitely agree there with you, because I think one of the mottos of my company Box, and that you see really going through startups these days, is simple UI and consumer friendly UI, in the sense that you, in the past with archaic software, you actually, you know, people needed manuals to understand how to run things. Really, what you want to be able to do is sit someone in front of an application who's never used it before and have them be able to run with it and be able to learn and use it relatively quickly. And Microsoft has taken some steps towards that direction, but there's just things which are not – which go out of the natural norms of – I want to say human perception. Maybe mm-hmm. I shouldn't be that granular, but it's out of everyday contents in how things currently flow. And I feel like it was in part and parcel due to a desire to differentiate themselves from, you know, things like how iOS does it, as well as maybe how Android does it with their swipes and gestures. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think I don't know if this was the best time to make such a drastic change in their infrastructure, at least yeah. that far to the norm.
You needed to. Now, once they were so far behind, right? Like,
right. Yeah. But the real problem here is how many people are actually going to go through that learning curve, or how many people are just going to be like
Microsoft. I mean, Microsoft. Let's not fake it. Microsoft has a huge following. Right? Like, huge. Microsoft is what is up with most consumers. Microsoft is a big, big deal. So I just feel like they have the ability to push people in a way that most people don't get pushed, like most companies can't do. Because people are like, well, I have a Microsoft laptop. If I get a tablet, if it can be Microsoft, why not? I have a Microsoft laptop or desktop, and I have an Xbox. Why not get a Windows phone? Like, if Microsoft leverages those existing relationships, then with the consumer, then like there's a possibility that they can really make movements here.
You know, there is, but I keep running into individuals. Like, actually today we were talking mm-hmm. about it, because there were a couple of us tech consultants huddled around the Surface trying to debug a couple issues here, and someone from one of our teams walks over and makes a quirky joke. How many tech consultants does it take to operate a Surface? And my colleague was like, okay, here, have the Surface, now launch Internet Explorer. And he couldn't do it immediately.
Internet Explorer is a whole controversy in itself, because Microsoft's like, our default is do not track on our browser. And then the freaking IAB, the Internet Advertising Bureau, said, yeah, we're not respecting that do not track, because they don't actually like stop the cookies from tracking. Mm-hmm. And they do it on default, and we need users to do that, because that's a user thing. So the whole IE10 thing and the Surface thing is kind of painful. There's also the app issue, where many of the apps on the Surface are not the apps you're used to. You can't type in Yelp and get something. You type in Yelp and get you, but you don't get Yelp. You get some other program that uses Yelp data, which is fine because it's a good program and it works really well. But as a consumer looking for a brand name, you're like, oh, it's not Yelp. So I feel like, yes, you're right. How many engineers does it take to debug the Surface? And how long does it take for the user to figure out what they can do with it because of a less than completely intuitive interface?
According to Microsoft, they said that they've sold 40 million Windows 8 licenses so far.
That's because it was $20 a pop and people can download it to their Windows machines. That's not a Surface.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I read the actually that was also funny because I went through that article and read the little byline at the very bottom of a ZDNet article.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, you know, they didn't actually specify what licenses sold meant, like if it actually included manufacturers. And when they actually asked Microsoft about it, they said, we have nothing more to share.
Hmm.
So it was kind of, I think it's somewhat telling in how they play around with the numbers.
Hmm.
Still very, very curious to see how it does, let's say, 6 months from now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and not to mention that by this same period of time, they had nearly doubled the number of Windows 7 licenses that they had sold. 60 million Windows 7 licenses sold within the same period of time when that OS launched. So they're down quite a bit, 20 million so far, and that sounds like a rate that isn't going to increase. So, but we'll see. Like, I'm really curious. I'm really curious to see how everyone ends up either adopting or not adopting a Windows 8. I've been playing with it for a while, and it really isn't that intuitive. So, hopefully, like we've talked about before on the show, I think this was a change that Windows had to make because of the whole paradigm shift from desktop general computing to mobile computing. So we'll see. But it apparently cost Steve Sinofsky his job. He was forestalled. He was forestalled out of Windows, ostensibly for the same, the rumors were basically the same sort of situation where Sinofsky was kind of overstepping his power boundaries and had to be taken out of the equation, much like what we heard about Scott Forstall over at Apple.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm very curious what happened to make them want to change their cards. And this was like a month after,
yeah.
Or was it a month after release or shorter than that?
It was a month after release of Windows 8 and Surface that Sinofsky was taken out. And replaced with Julie Larson Green, corporate vice president of Program Management Windows Client is her official title. So who knows where it's going from here on? But I mean, for someone who, and you know, you remember when the Surface had their preview keynote, and Sinofsky led that, and he led it so effectively and confidently that he seemed like the golden boy, and it's just weird to see this kind of situation after a supposedly a successful launch of both the OS and the new device.
Yeah, I would say it's more fodder for the Microsoft naysayers.
So. Right. Speaking of people being fired, Apple has fired the manager responsible for the mapping software for Apple Maps, seeking to win back the trust of users disappointed after the program debuted in September, according to people familiar with the move. Richard Williamson, who oversaw the mapping team, was pushed out by Senior Vice President Eddie Q. Q, who took over last month as part of a management shakeup, is seeking advice from outside mapping technology experts and prodding digital maps provider TomTom to fix landmark and navigation data it shares with Apple. So the bleeding continues. The bleeding at high up at the upper echelons of both Microsoft and Apple continues in the wake of these dubious launches, product launches. So we'll see. Who knows if that'll fix Apple's maps problem in the in the long term. Certainly, I don't know if it's done anything for it in the short term, but there we go.
It's kind of funny. So I actually use Apple Maps on a regular basis to get me around. Mm-hmm. I will say at times it doesn't use the shortest, or at times doesn't use the smartest route. and it may you may be going through some other streets which may get you on the right side of the road, but not necessarily the shortest path. But at least in the Silicon Valley area,
yeah,
which is of course where Apple's headquarters are located, it seems to be pretty good. Now, I will say, I am new to the area, so my perception may be a bit incorrect in terms of, you know, I may not actually know the most efficient way to take things, and clearly I haven't used it in the city, so that could also be my my lack of understanding there. But it's been okay for me. I know of, you know, I have lots of friends who definitely do not believe so, and are actually very surprised that Google Maps hasn't made its way there yet, but mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll cover that in a little bit. But yeah, for me, it's been okay. What about your experiences?
You know, it's interesting. I spoke earlier how I went to Seattle, just came back from Seattle, and I'd never been to Seattle before, so it was my first time up there, did all the touristy stuff, and I brought my both my iPhone and my iPad with me, and I was pleasantly surprised at how well the you know, the one of the things I love the most about Apple Maps is that whole miniature world in your hand feature of the 3D view. When Apple Maps first launched, there was a lot of ugliness as far as that goes. Like, a lot of the models were really sort of distorted and warped. But I was really pleasantly surprised at how well improved it was, at least in the Seattle area, when I was looking at the maps, the mapping out in that area. However, I will say that I was still quite disappointed that there's really no way. We took public transportation. We didn't rent a car. There's really no way to sort of find point-to-point routes via public transportation in Apple Maps the way there used to be in Google Maps. So it actually kind of left us stranded in a couple of different places because we couldn't find public transportation, and trying to get onto Google Maps via the internet, the straight-up internet, was a little spotty too because of the coverage, the cell phone coverage that we were receiving in the area of Seattle that we were. So there were a couple of inconvenient moments in traveling from point to point that would not have been a problem had Google had a native Apple iOS apps program. I think that takes us through the first part of our headlines here. Before we get into the second half here, let's take a little break and talk about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com. And for the Drill Down listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk about this week is called SEAL Team 666 by Weston Oakes. And I picked this purely on the title alone because I thought it was a great concept. It's basically SEAL Team 6 meets Stephen King in a novel about an elite group of soldiers who protect the United States from supernatural threats. And actually, while I was looking through this, the synopsis of this, I discovered that from the author left a little note that this story has been picked up by one of the, like, some major studio, I can't remember which, to be a feature film. And it's just it's the perfect sort of high concept novel. A crack Marine troop versus a supernatural threat. I mean, it practically writes itself. But so this was an interesting concept, and I'm recommending it on that basis alone. So that's SEAL Team 666 by Weston Oakes, and that book or any of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles can be yours. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. and the 30-day trial. Even if you don't like the service, you get to keep SEAL Team 666. I'm just going to keep saying that because it's so much fun. You can keep that book forever. So give them a try. We're going to take a brief little break here, but when we come back, we've got a few more headlines to go through. So take a listen to this and come on back.
On a long and lonesome highway east of Omaha, you can listen to the engine of mourning out his one old song. You can think about the woman or the girl you knew the night before. But your thoughts will soon be wandering the way they always do. When you're riding 16 hours, there's nothing much to do. And you don't feel much like riding, you just wish the trip was through.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin, and let's crack into some of these more of these headlines. Now, we talked before the break about Apple firing their Apple Maps manager and
iOS manager. Bam.
Yeah. So, continuing in that same theme, we've heard that Google is actually prepping their Maps app for Apple iPhones, which is going to be a godsend for me because I just...
Google could think about hiring Scott Forstall to make Android's native OS, like just that sort of like naked, non-skinned, whatever... have a bit of polish. I know they're working on it with Jelly Bean. I know they're working on it with ice cream. I know they're working on it. But yeah. Forstall, you
That's
know,
not
that
a bad
iOS
idea.
Experience is serious. And there's a reason why it's like that. And he was a big part of that.
That's not a bad idea as long as Forstall doesn't stick to that whole skeuomorphism sort of aesthetic.
I think he's learned his lesson. Yes. I think he figured that out. But that isn't the reason why they got rid of him. The reason they got rid of him is manyfold, and that skeuomorphism is there, but it's not the reason. And I think when it comes to a different platform, a man like Forrestal will take a different approach, but it allows for him to think about the software based on the user experience in a way that like codifies it and solidifies and everything. Now, I'm not saying Forrest is ready to get back in the game and work for the competition, and I'm sure there was a great exit package that was focused on a non-compete and yada, yada, yada. But... I'm just saying, talent out there, you know.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. No, I think he's hugely talented. He's already proven that, and I think he'd be a welcome addition to any of Apple's competitors, given enough non-compete time there. Moving on here, if you want to know just how broken the patent system is, just look at patent D677-13 filed by Apple and approved this week by the U.S. Patent Office.
Before you go on,
yeah,
the fact that the patent begins with the letter D means it's a design patent, and all design patents, I think everybody in the world would agree who's a patent freak, are janky. A real patent is just a number. Design patent is like,
patenting design in the first place?
Hey man, that's what patents do. They patent. I mean, that's what it comes down to. But design patents are almost on the level of the mythical idea of the software patent. There's no such thing as a software patent. There are patents on software, but there's no classification of patent that is a software patent. However, a design patent is a real classification, and it's a real janky classification because, really, that is so not necessarily specific.
I think janky would be an apt description of the patent that Apple was granted, which is titled Display Screen or Portion Thereof with Animated Graphical User Interface, which gives Apple the exclusive rights to the page turn in an e-reader application. So that's right. Apple now owns the page turn.
How long and they don't have a page turn right anymore.
How long? Yeah. How long before they start enforcing that across the board with all the competitors? Mm-hmm. They're gonna shut page turns out of the market for everybody else but Apple.
Although I gotta say, I enjoy the fact that I would like it if I could treat a book like a web page and just read down without turning the page.
Yeah, you know what I was thinking about that too. I was thinking about in respect to this particular patent is that a page turn is once again one of those. To me, one of the skeuomorphic touches, it's a...
less than that, because pages are still referenced when you think about books. It's a little more than that, because it's not just there for the sake of being there. But in a completely native digital experience,
right,
you could scroll down, theoretically,
right,
and be fine.
Right.
Well, PDFs do that.
Yep.
Right?
Like, nowadays, I don't even... When I'm, in the world of ebooks, I don't even really think about pages as a point of reference anymore now as much as I do percent.
I will say that I can't get around the percentage. I get the native aspect of it. It's native digital percentage. How far along are you? But when we live in a world of mixed media, the fact that the analog user of that same piece of text has a page that you can refer to is still useful.
Right. Yes, that's true. It is important when you're dealing with mixed media. Otherwise you can just refer someone to a particular bookmark, like a digital bookmark. Send that digital bookmark to them, and they can open up the same bookmark in their copy of the book. So I think page turn as a concept in digital media is probably an archaic concept that's going away anyway. So Apple's awardment of this patent is just in time for it to be obsolete, I think.
But I guess the real question is, how did this even pass? How is someone able to judge that? Really, this is a solid patent for Apple to own exclusively.
All it is a rule of law. If you work in these places, patent offices, wherever, the rule of law that makes it to a lot of countries in this weird chaotic space is the same thing that says, it's not my job to judge this thing. Are they playing by the rules? Yes. They got here first? Yes. These are the rules? Yes, it's done.
Yeah.
And that might be the fundamental problem with the patent system.
Yeah, that is. There really isn't anyone there to judge with any sort of expertise on...
Judges are for. The idea is that you have to spend money on a real judge in a real court to challenge that. So if you're a company that's really focused on protecting yourself, then you move forward with these patents early and often. Because you have to play the game based on the rules, not based on how you feel the rules should be.
Right.
And only then, and only then, once you have everything you need, can you worry about working with a system to make things the way they should be. But really, what it comes down to is that, as a user, as a part of a system, you have to work within that system. You have to work within the rules, right? Like, that's just it. So, is this patent meaningful to people like you and me and Tosin and probably CRISPR and Orin to bring your hardware? Not so much. But is it useful in terms of their ability to enforce it? Yes, because there's a whole system of laws and rules that surrounds that, and they're playing the game. And any game has rules, and the world is not the Matrix. It's not about bending them. It's about following them in order to get what you want.
I really wish that there would be some reform in patent law soon so that the rules aren't as fucked up as they are, because look at how much money that we're spending. Not we are, but companies are spending on on patent, defending themselves against patents. Billions and billions of dollars every year. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's kind of weird.
And it stifles technology.
Economic, like, one. It's not like an economic, a good way to spend money.
Right, right. I'm sure all these companies would wish that they wouldn't have to spend that expense, but it's at this point it's like the nuclear stalemate. You know, they all have to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on here. Nintendo of America president Reggie Fils-Aimé told CNET in a phone interview that last week, internal data has shown that total U.S. hardware sales have reached more than 1.2 million units. That includes the Wii U, the Wii, the 3DS, and the DS. According to Fils-Aimé, Nintendo sold over 700,000 consoles in the last week. The Wii U topped the Wii with 400,000 units sold. He said that the Wii U is essentially sold out of retail, and they're doing their best to continually replenish stock. Retailers are doing their best to get the product to store shelves, but as soon as
they did it last time, dude, they just didn't make enough.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question. I mean, this brings up like a bigger point, and in particular about the Wii U. The Wii U is a, I'm quoting here from a New York Times article. The Wii U is a recognition that the living room is no longer the province of a single screen. More people, particularly the young, now watch TV with a smartphone or tablet in hand, the better to tweet a touchdown or update their Facebook status during a commercial. But will it be the blowout that Nintendo needs? Many industry veterans and game reviewers are skeptical. They question whether the Wii U can be as successful as the original now that many gamers have moved on to more abundant, cheaper, and more convenient mobile games. Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Atari, said that he doesn't think it's going to be a big success, that these things will continue to sputter along, but they won't. Gaming consoles in general won't be of any major import ever again. It feels like the end
of an
era.
That's why the seventh generation of gaming consoles lasts so long, because they've had to differentiate from actually gaming and move into things like HD video and other sources
of content. Set-top boxes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think the 360 has held its own for a while by doubling up as a set-top box, and the same
goes with PS3.
PS3 with Blu-ray support.
They're able to deliver HD, which the Wii wasn't.
Yeah, yeah. So, and the Wii doesn't have any of that. I think that does the Wii U have DVD support even, or
it doesn't really have DVD support, but it does have Netflix support. It's just it's just SD next.
Sure. I guess that's all that matters nowadays, is that it can do set top box, dual delivery as a set top box. But that's a good question.
It's kind of what matters. But if you had a Wii and then you had an Xbox, you'd never use the Wii for that. And there was also the problem with the Wii not really allowing you to connect with individuals without that crazy long code, as opposed to just using it.
Which so they've ditched this time around.
It was an example, and I think DaVinci was hit this most. It's an example of Japanese stubbornness when it comes to normal user paradigms. It's kind of not okay.
Yeah.
And well, they have fixed it, at least for the Wii U. I've seen, at least from what I've heard so far from friends who end up picking up the consoles, they're enjoying it. Now, then again, these are individuals who, you know, planned to pick it up and picked it up early. So that does lead to a somewhat of a bias, I would assume. But they seem to be having a good time with it. Right, exactly. There's nothing about it which pulls me as a gamer towards it. There's nothing that stirs me to say, oh, I need this now, or I even need this in another year or so. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, especially among Christmas time when they have somewhat of a stock back in.
Right.
But have you guys got to play around with one, or have any friends who've picked them up? Or
I played around with one.
I won't be touching a Wii U for, I think, a year probably at this point, mostly because I'm not a big gaming guy, and I definitely don't have any close friends who are crazy about the Nintendo systems.
I played around with one at two consecutive E3s, so I have experienced it. But I can't say that I was like it, I wasn't overwhelmingly compelled to get one this time around, and I have to say that even with my Wii experience, like I really enjoyed the Wii for the first like 2 or 3 months that I owned it, and then it sat in a corner. I haven't touched the original.
Well, I mean,
Wii.
I'll play Mario Kart any day of the week.
Sure. I mean, there's some individual games that are, but on the whole, as a device, it's really fallen by the wayside. In as opposed to the PS3, which I've used constantly on a multiple times a week basis. So, and I was actually surprised about that because I thought for sure that the whole handheld active paradigm was going to shift the industry on a whole. And it seems that, you know, like I still enjoy sitting down on a couch with the controller in my hand and doing it old fashioned way. So, I really don't know if adding a second screen to the controller is going to be the thing that's the tipping point to get me to get a new console. And that really brings up a question about the future consoles of Microsoft and Sony. I mean, what do they have to do at this point to entice people to get that new console system?
So maybe they don't have to do anything in particular. Microsoft and Sony have shown that over time they have developed consoles that remain in the same generation but have updated kind of like how an iPhone updates. It's got the same aspect. It's a different form factor.
Mm-hmm.
With the same core functionality, with maybe it's quieter, maybe it's this and that, and maybe over time they don't have to move to an 8th generation. Maybe over time all they have to do is continue to deliver new, more efficient, more laid back PS3s indefinitely. Now, will they do this? Probably not. They'll have a PS4 eventually, whatever. What I'm saying is it may not be necessary to revamp the whole thing. It may be better to say, you know, our SDK for the games includes a clock, so no matter how fast you make the chip, the clock is there. Mm-hmm. But your experience when it comes to navigating the console will be better. Your experience when doing other things with the console will be better because what we've done is made the console better over time without you having to lose anything. Because we found cheaper ways to make the console, so it's cheaper, some more people have it, so we can get more of it, whatever. What they failed to do is, I think Microsoft does this with Xbox Live, but what Sony has failed to do is create a kind of platform-focused revenue stream. So you're not paying Sony for access to Netflix where you're paying Microsoft for access to Netflix on the Xbox 360. Mm-hmm. Just like Apple's getting paid 30% for purchases on their store. And I feel like if they can pull that off, then there's no real reason why they have to create, you know, completely new marketing campaigns around completely new hardware. Hardware will eventually die if you've got a 6-year-old Xbox, PlayStation, and it's not doing what it should be doing because it's old. You will replace it, and as long as they have a device to replace it that's going to allow you to play the same games, I think you'll be okay.
Yeah, I'm curious how far along the road we are for that sort of thing to occur. Just because at least with the last iteration. With consoles, at least the last iteration of consoles and before that, for at least the big names, at least for Sony and Microsoft, not necessarily for Nintendo, they're losing a significant chunk of money on the consoles. And it's always been made up in game revenue stream.
Not anymore
due to the lifetime of the console, right? But for initial purchases, right? So when the console was brand new, just buying a new 360 at that time was a huge market loss for them, at least from what I can recall. And I know that I think the interesting dynamic here is because these are really more like mini PCs, right? To a certain extent, a lot of the changes which they can do with the UI, they can really just do via software, at least at this current iteration. And I think that's why a majority of new consoles that I find that like my friends get mm-hmm. is more about the design and the look. Like the Halo console must have been pretty All cheap right. for them to make, and it looks really pretty. And that's I had quite a few friends go out and purchase that just for its actual look and not necessarily for the functionality.
The case design, essentially.
Yep.
Well, it's right. interesting.
That I mean, that's why they can sell a $400 Star Wars version of the Xbox.
Right.
Well, but maybe here's an interesting thing to think about. Maybe the way to go is the way, you know, if OnLive were still around right now, I would say that would be a harbinger of the future. Because maybe the way to go is, since bandwidth is so, everyone has high-speed bandwidth, and OnLive has proven that cloud gaming works, maybe Microsoft and Sony and future next-generation console makers don't have to work as hard on the hardware, and they can just deliver a cloud gaming experience and build up the infrastructure on their end.
Or they can have two pieces of hardware. Like, one piece of hardware is focused on the, okay, you're going to download content and play it on your stuff with some connection to the internet. Mm-hmm. Another focus is, like, you're going to play it directly on the cloud services. OnLive is cool because it allows that. What I really don't like with my Xbox that I have to put, like, I bought Gears of War, and I'm annoyed that I can't just buy that game online like I would on my iPhone and just go with it.
Right.
You know? I'm annoyed that I'm stuck thinking about when I can put the disc in. I really hate putting the disc in. Like, it's a fundamental hatred of an unnecessary process.
I think those days are going away too.
But they're not gone soon enough. I was born 10 years too early, is what I'm saying. So it's really what it comes down to. Because I whether it's Blu-rays or whatever,
the
idea that I need a disc in a format and it has to go in the system, I have to press a button, the tray comes out, moving parts. I stopped using moving parts cell phones in like 2004.
Sure.
You know, like I got candy bars in 2004 because I need that Sony whatever to do my, you know, bidding when it came to like, you know, downloading stuff on the whatever. So it's like this paradigm is over.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to remain over.
Speaking of video games, did you guys check out the new GTA 5 trailer?
Anybody yes.
Yeah, that was pretty phenomenal. Like they put out two trailers so far. And ever since the first trailer, and with the addition of this trailer, I'm ready to play this game. And I think the only the thing is that like the ideal video game for me is one that puts me in an immersive world, fully realized world. And Rockstar has been like they have been, I think, done more than any other game developer to really, truly, fully realize their world, build out their worlds to an environment that you can actually believe you're in the middle of. And
maybe for a game console developer, but the computer industry, the games have been able to help you get into that for a long, long time.
Sure, you know, but like, I mean, especially
the time Quake 3 allowed you to shoot the walls and leave marks. You were immersed, even without a story. There was no story. You were just there. You were there, which means that's all that mattered. A guy gets in the way, kill him. That kind of thing.
But this latest trailer, I mean, it really feels very immersive. I mean, it looks like everything you can fly planes and helicopters and the whole nine yards, and It feels like you're really, you know, this takes place in a fictional city, but it's really a fictional city modeled after Los Angeles. And I actually recognize experiences, Los Angeles, specific Los Angeles experiences from this trailer that really makes me very excited to play this game. I want to live in that world. The only downside about that, and it's just part and parcel of it, comes with the territory of the GTA series, is that I'm not entirely crazy about that the criminal lifestyle.
Well, because you're a dad now.
Well, maybe that's what it is. I don't know. Maybe that's. I mean, I wish there was a game where it was just as immersive, just as fully built, but doesn't necessarily make me, you know, want to be a mob member or punch a hooker in the mouth, you know. Maybe I'm just being old fashioned because I used to love to punch hookers in the mouth with the GTA 3.
That could be the case. There is a game, and I'll have to look it up and see if I can grab the title during this. But there was this game which was, I think, shown during E3 this year. It was a computer game where it was kind of cool because, unlike other games, you could actually use technology in terms of, you know.
I know the game you're talking about.
Yes, that seems like it would be maybe the type of thing for you. I can't recall the title to it. Do you remember?
I will look it up while we have the discussion. But yeah, no, I do totally remember that. I saw the trailer that they had put out for that game, and I was blown away because to me that game felt so much like the original Deus Ex experience, where it's right. This total immersive world and you get to do just about anything. You use your cell phone to trigger all sorts of like network connected events within the world. You could make stoplights change their change their signal, or walk into a nightclub and spot like the person most likely to punch you in the face. I'll come up with the name of it, but that does look like a phenomenal game.
Yeah, as far as the trailers go, the first GTA trailer was really more of a here's what the world looks like trailer, where they showed you know what they'd been able to improve from a graphical perspective, the cars or the buildings, make it look very LA-like. And the second trailer really gives you more of that cinematic story-like feel, where you now get a handle on who some of these main players are and some of the events which they tossed in there. I was like, oh, that's totally Skyfall. That's, you know, these are Bond events. These are more action-oriented events. Really trying to, on a larger scale, trying to do a sort of Uncharted-esque playthrough is how I would consider it. Mm-hmm. And it just looks like a lot of fun. The only issue I have with those type of games is GTA. The GTA series has really been done pretty well by Rockstar with all the titles they've come out. I'm not sure if anyone would say that one particularly has been very poor quality. It's just, for me, a world that expansive, I sometimes just get lost. Or you know what I actually tend to enjoy doing at times is getting in a car, you know, turning on the radio and just driving.
See, that is an awesome experience. I love that. I love that. Sandbox. You're not crazy about that, Dwayne?
Well, GTA, I find like, all right. So, for me, I definitely like an immersive experience. I want a movie that I can be a part of.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Boom. Okay.
But sometimes, I'm in GTA and there's not enough of a concrete way forward for me to be excited about actually moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess don't.
Well, hopefully this
this idea about sitting around and just driving a car while I'm in my living room, that will never appeal to me.
But it's the music and the sunset.
I can get the music on Pandora and I can play basketball while I do it. Like, I like to, I'm an outdoor geek. I like to be outside. I like to be outside and do stuff. I like to snowboard with my music and actually have my body do the moving at like 60 miles an hour on a snowboard and actually get that rush of I can break my neck if I fuck it up. And so when I'm at home, the idea of like just kind of sitting around and getting fat while playing a video game really does turn me off. This is a video game that really stretches my mind or makes me focus on something important. Like StarCraft is an economic game more than it is a war game. I have to think about my economic, like, production possibility frontier. What is the risk associated with what I'm about to do? What is the gain, you know? Mm-hmm. But when I'm just sitting there, like, I can't get into that just to shoot anything anymore. That was when I was 22. That was when I was 20, actually. Like, I'm going to play some Quake 3 and, like, whip your ass, and that's what it is.
Yeah.
I can't get into a game for the sake of just driving around in a car, because I can actually get in a car and drive around.
Yeah, but like gas prices.
You know, you can say that, but I mean, like, if I really, if that, in fact, when I get in a car today, I barely listen to music. I typically do things like listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You know, that kind of thing.
I seriously doubt that there's any PBS stations in GTA 5. Maybe, but that would be really...
That'd be hilarious. Car talk, right?
That would be hilarious.
Right. What I'm saying is that I don't get a lot of value out of that aspect of the paradigm. Oh, it's so real. I don't have to be real. Like, I'd just be real because I want to be doing stuff. I want to be, like, running in the cold in my new, like, running tights, like a jackass, and listen to music that way. Or sure. I want to be playing the game in real life instead of, like, playing NBA 2K13 or whatever.
That's understandable. But I guess, have you ever played any of the Uncharted series, like Uncharted 2 or Arkham City, the Batman game?
I haven't played those games, though. I haven't played Batman Arkham City. In fact, I looked at the Batman Arkham City stuff, and I actually was not excited.
Hmm,
I don't know why.
Uncharted is great.
If it's a game that I can delve in, like, you know, I got Gears of War. There's something exciting about that because that exists. I can't be a super commando in a destroyed future in which I have to save the world. I can't do that. But I can drive around in a car.
So for you, the furthest from the quotidian life of reality, the better for you.
I need escapism if I'm going to join a game.
All right. I can't do that.
I'm not so much into the MMORPG. And I think that there are people out, like, when I think about, like, work-life balance and, like, tech-life balance, like, I'm a lover of the Fitbit because when it does work, it doesn't always work, but when it does work, it's allowing me to gauge how I live my life. It's not technology, it isn't in for itself. I love my Mac because it allows me to do things like my work and get updates on, like, you know, Twitter and Facebook really easily, much more easily than on my Windows machines. You know, I like my iPhone because it allows me to, like, get things done. And that's what I want my technology to do. Let me get things done. Mm-hmm. Let me, my Wemo, to make my sure that my house is humidified before I get it home. But right, I don't right, like right. to just to kind of sit there in front of something and pretend that I'm vegging by, like, using a video. You know what I'm saying? That's me. Yeah. But I don't want to digress anymore. That's just, like, my personal geek philosophy.
All right. Let's move on here. There's only a couple more headlines here in our show before we close it up.
Very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Before we forget. Absolutely.
The game which we were discussing is called Watch Dogs.
Make
sure we mention that.
I'll put a link in the show notes to the... I'll actually link the trailer for Watch Dogs. It's Ubisoft is the developer. And it was basically the show of E3 of last year. The one holdout show game of last year's E3. So I will embed a trailer so that everyone can look at that. And yeah, that's definitely another one that I'm looking forward to. There's no release date on that yet. It's in development. And it's not entirely certain if it's going to be what console it's going to go on. But moving on here, last Wednesday, Facebook sent its largest email blast to date, informing all 1 billion users that it's proposing to modify the site's governance structure and remove the ability for users to vote on changes. Currently, if proposed changes get over 7,000 comments, all users may vote on them, and if over 30% of the vote for or against changes, their decision is binding. Facebook wants to replace the system with a focus on soliciting high-quality feedback through new features. If the 7,000 comment threshold isn't met, or it is and fewer than 300 million users vote to block the proposal, users will no longer be able to vote on the governance alterations. Now, this was bit of news sort of rippled throughout the blogosphere, but I can't decide whether this is necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, and I was hoping that one of you could maybe shed a little bit more light on this for me and tell me whether or not this is Facebook once again trying to screw over its user base, or if it's something that is...
No one's getting screwed. Facebook had a different way of doing things. They were not a public company. They didn't have public rules. Facebook has to... It's not... Dig. It's not Reddit. It's not a user governed community. It is Facebook. It's always been Zucker Brothers' situation. It will always be Zucker Brothers' situation. And if you deluded yourself into thinking that either A, oh, you had a say in it, or B, you could put up some whack, janky, fake post about how, like,
all well, the that's a whole other situation. I mean, I think,
like, bottom line is that this isn't yours.
Right.
You
right,
are
right.
The product. When you're on Facebook, you are the product. If you don't like it, leave Facebook. Simple as that.
So, I mean, essentially, they're just changing their way that you are, that they
took advantage of this. Did you ever vote?
No.
You were on Facebook for at least 6 years. You ever vote?
No.
How about you? Tosin, you ever vote on Facebook?
I have not voted on Facebook.
Thank you. It doesn't change a damn thing. It's a non-issue. It is the press talking, which they should talk, but it's not worth a lot of time because no one ever voted on Facebook or even knew they could.
Yeah, I honestly didn't even know that I could vote to change the way Facebook does things. So I just assumed that they whatever is in their terms of use is in their terms of use, and
like every other site in which you take part of without having to pay.
Right. No, the article that I'm quoting here says that if there's a global catastrophe, corporate takeover of Facebook, or some other incident that impacted all 1 billion users, the vote could be necessary. It could let users authorize the use of Facebook data for international security or disaster relief, or block the ability of new owners of the company from selling away people's personally identifiable data, something Facebook does not do currently. So, yeah.
I mean, the minute Facebook's new, if Facebook was to be bought, let's just say that a company that had a lot of money, like Apple, bought Facebook. Let's say the regulators let that happen. And then Apple, even though it's notoriously anti-advertisement, decides to sell all the data they had on Facebook to advertisers or media companies or whatever. That is the day Facebook becomes MySpace and something new pops up, like app.net becomes real. You know? Like, there's a disincentive to treat the user like that, because as much as the user is the product, you have to respect the fact that it's not a question of I'm going to farm out their email address to get like a whole bunch of spam in their inbox.
Right.
There's no incentive economically for Facebook to screw you.
Right.
Like, it's what it is. And so, like, I feel like a lot of like people on the tech side, we're all bleeding heart liberals, and that's great. But the fact is, you have to look at follow the money. If Facebook screws you, it loses its cool factor, and you will move somewhere else.
Yep.
Facebook has a cool factor. I'm kidding.
And finally, our last headline here. There was a meme spreading on Facebook that Facebook is making a change related to ownership of users' information or the content they post to the site, which is false. Anyone who uses Facebook owns and controls the content and information they post, as stated in their terms. They control how the content and information is shared. That is Facebook's policy, and it always has been, according to Facebook. And the result of this meme spreading was that everyone was posting on their Facebook page a quote about how stating that they own their property according to some intellectual property law that doesn't actually exist. And so if you or anyone you didn't fall for this, this essentially what this is a hoax.
It's actually like a couple months old. I had a friend put it up on his thing, and I was like, wait, what? And I read it, and as a person who works in the legal side of the advertising industry, I said, dude, this is not real. And he was like, no, it's at least protecting me. And I'm like,
no. Something that you put in your Facebook post is not going to protect you from the terms of service that you agreed to.
You might express how you feel about shit, but it's going to stop you. There's no protection, because there's no – you don't need to be protected from anything.
Right.
If you open your mouth on Facebook, you open your mouth on Facebook. If you like have these – when it comes to the actual privacy stuff that you put up, that's what you put up. Now, Facebook, if it judges that you are doing something either illegal or sketchy or whatever, it will divulge that information directly to the United States authorities in question – because it understands it's part of society. It's part of the way people express themselves. And if it sees like a 33-year-old guy like me talking to a 13-year-old girl in a way that's not okay, it's going to say something. And you know what? I'm not too worried about that.
Well, yeah. There you go. I mean, basically the bottom line is don't put anything online that you don't want everyone to potentially see.
Right. Wise words of the internet.
So, gentlemen, anything else that we didn't cover tonight before we sign off?
I was saying that we're going to live in a world where LTE is a standard.
Yeah.
Right? Like, next year, people's internet connections will be faster on their phones than they will be in their houses. What the fuck is Comcast going to do?
Right. You know? Plus, not to mention, and I saw a little article about this today, is that once Google Fiber takes off and starts spreading from community to community, I really hope that happens, because that's going to really be a bellwether event, getting on Google's, you know, high-speed fiber connection. Because that's essentially going to mean the end of other internet service providers as far as cable companies or DSL. Does anybody still...
Well, it's going to disrupt. It's going to disrupt.
It's going to totally disrupt. Anyway, let's go around the table here, and I'll start with our guest, Toast. Tosin. I'm sorry. It's Tosin, right?
Tosin, but Toast is my nickname, and that's actually one of the ways you can reach me. You can find me on twitter.com/toast, like the bread, 4321, as well as I do a podcast called Irresponsible Random Chatter, and you can find that at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
And Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the show?
Twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. It's also flavors.me/DwayneD. And you can always find me on the Drill Down, because, you know, it's the Drill Down. And I like to drill down.
All right.
Ladies.
You heard it here first. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to/MrBabyMan. Facebook. .com/MrBabyMan, twitter.com/MrBabyMan. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our link is on the upper right hand sidebar there. Our show's on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, other devices. Go to Stitcher.com and find The Drill Down there. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@TheDrillDown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@TheDrillDown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down.
We decided to celebrate Black Friday, and what I decided to do for Black Friday is we got a whole bunch of friends together from all areas of the valley. We got ourselves some KFC, some orange soda, and some purple drink.
Oh,
really cheap stuff. And so we start off with the movie Cool Runnings, because we started off in Jamaica/Canada.
Black Friday, Jamaica.
We then moved to Coming to America, which a lot of people hadn't seen. I was very shocked.
I love that
about
movie.
That.
Sexual chocolate.
Yep. Yes. Then we also interspersed with, of course, Lana's best episodes from Archer. And then we wrapped it up with Black Dynamite.
Was that a 70s movie, Black Dynamite?
No. Have you not seen Black Dynamite?
It's a recent film that's set in the 70s, right?
Yes, yes. Blaxploitation film made a couple years ago.
Friends of yours.
How many black friends of mine participated? Like one.
Wow, you have one?
Well, you know, I am new to this area, of course. So, and then actually afterwards we got ice cream, had played pool, and used scooters around, which was kind of, so we went to our office. We always stop by the office. Went to our office at like 1 in the morning, played pool for like half an hour, and then we're like, we've always wanted to use the scooters we have in the office in the garage, which is like a 2-layer garage underneath. So we took like, so it's been like 6-7 people on scooters flying through the garage at like 2 in the morning.
I saw those Facebook posts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We made an album for it. It was pretty awesome.
Nice. Boss.
Best Black Friday ever.
Friday.
Yep.
That's super cool. That beats my Black Friday.
What did you do for your Black Friday?
I was at home, basically. I stayed at home. I vowed ever since the Black Friday that I got up extra early to get the Nintendo Wii and nearly froze my butt off in like sub 40 degree temperatures.
Are you kidding me? You
well, it's California. Come on, it's California. Cut me a break. But ever since then, I vowed.
You're on the phone with Massachusetts and New York.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. Everything's relative.
He grows from Massachusetts and New York.
it's all relative. You have to understand. We could probably handle the heat better than you guys can out here in California. But I mean, ever since that winter, I vowed never to do another brick and mortar Black Friday again. It's going to be all Amazon from there on. So I did do Amazon. I bought some super cheap Blu-rays that were like $3, $4, and up to $7 max for great titles like Gone with the Wind and
yeah, I saw
Iron
a lot
Man
of
2.
Super deals, but I don't really. I buy Blu-rays every once in a while. Yeah. I still do Netflix discs actually, mm-hmm. and that's
that.
Mainly where I do my Blu-ray consumption.
Because I can give them back.
Yeah, no.
Blu-ray's littering my house.
I have a few. Like the last one I bought was the Avengers. Mm-hmm. But like to tell you the truth, I started thinking about it. How often do I go back and watch a movie I own? There's always some new movie or movie which I haven't seen.
It's the disc. It's the getting the disc out of the package and putting that in like a device and then sitting back and watching it. If I want to watch something, I want to sit on my couch, use my remote control, and scroll through some shit.
But so the quality.
What?
The quality. Right.
1080p, Blu-ray on my Apple TV.
Oh, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
I'm old-fashioned.
When you have a Drobo 5D, you don't worry about the quality.
I'm kind of a Luddite when it comes to physical media. Like, I still want to own the physical media. And actually, it's only about movies now, because I've long since, like, sloughed off my holdouts against physical media when it comes to music. Like I can't even imagine buying a CD at this point. But for me, movies still, I need to have that physical.
And there's free downloads for the music. Rod Stewart and Mary J. Blige released their free download of We Three Kings. And if you're a person from between the age of 1979 and 1988, you are in heaven when you hear that.
Rod Stewart, huh? Wow.
And Mary J. Blige. Mary J. Blige.